Let's talk.
Hello, WGN listening audience.
Live from the biggest small town in America, it's the Saturday Night Special with Amy Goof.
Hey, it's Amy Guth, and thank you for tuning in and sharing your Saturday night with me. Tonight on the program, we're going to focus on books and authors. And while we normally dig into the art and the business of book creation when we talk about this topic, writing, publishing, and so on, tonight we'll talk with three authors about the subject of their work. And not just the subject, but the stories behind the stories too. And why do we even read books or stories or articles anyway? Why do we do it? It seems like kind of a foolish question, yeah, but really, why? Carl Sagan said a book is proof that humans are capable of working magic. Galileo thought reading was a way of using and celebrating superhuman power innate in all of us. James Baldwin aimed pretty big too in his thoughts on reading, calling it a way to change our destinies. As I've said on past book shows that we've done previously, the books that we read, both nonfiction and fiction, offer a retreat from the sometimes confusing and challenging world, while also helping us to better understand it and better grasp all of the knowledge we possibly can that exists within it. Indeed, literature and really stories of all kinds help us better understand ourselves, our communities, our histories, as well as hopefully helping us have a more compassionate view of people that we know and people that we don't. And even maybe it helps us try to make sense of big issues that often have many narratives, confusing ones, and of events happening in the world around us. As with many topics that we tackle on this program, there is always more to it once we start digging into it. Stories rarely exist in a vacuum, but rather they're often in response to social or political, emotional or personal struggles. So books, whether fiction or nonfiction, aren't just willed into existence. There's a lot of work that goes into each: research, writing, rewriting, business, all of that, to be sure. But there's also the big why. Why this book? Why this subject? And why right now? Why is this the story a given author wanted or even badly needed to write? That's what we aim to find out this evening on the show. We will talk with Elizabeth Weitzman, film critic and author of Renegade Women of Film and TV, and with Marina Mulars, the author of Welcome to Freedom Point. And then we'll close out the show with Ben Austin, author of High Risers, Cabrini-Green, and The Fate of American Public Housing. We'll talk with each about their work and about what drives them to write, as well as the stories that lie beneath their stories, the stories that brought their books to life. I'm Amy Guth, and that is all coming up tonight on the Saturday Night Special. We probably will not have a lot of time for phone calls, but feel free to send in comments and say hello by text message 312-981-7200 or through Twitter, where you can find me. I'm at Amy Guth, G-U-T-H there. With all that said, let's get into it. We'll be right back to get the conversation underway on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special with you till 9 o'clock. Well, as ever, we pick one big old topic and we talk about it all evening long. And that topic tonight is all about books and reading. We're going to talk with some authors coming up after the 7:30 news, which I'm really excited about. We're talking with three authors tonight, all very, very different in terms of the books they have written, their style of writing, the work that they have done. And I'm very excited to talk with all of them. But, you know, I think we can't possibly do a show about reading and books and all that as we do at least once a year, but we can't do that really without talking about some context of like why we read, why it even matters. I feel like it's in our culture of busyness where it's so prized to be, I mean, I call it an epidemic, right, where it's so sexy and valuable to be too busy to do anything. And indeed, many of us are very, very busy, but busyness is kind of supposed to be validating and prized. I hear so many people bragging about, oh yeah, I read the back of the book jacket. I don't have time to read. I hear so many people doing that. And, you know, indeed, I've got some friends that read so much. I mean, so much. And I don't read as much as I would like to, but I do, you know, try to read every single day. If not part of a book, I try to read some kind of long read, some big story about something, and try to read a couple different points of view on a given topic that I'm interested in. But indeed, I think it's such a simple question when you go, why do we read? What do we do that for? It kind of at first like, well, to get information. But I think there's so much more to that. And there's a lot of data that we have dug up for you looking all about that. This is one piece of information that I found so fascinating. Scientists at the University of Sussex in the UK, they studied how different kinds of activities lowered stress in terms of heart rate and muscle tensions in particular. So they were monitoring stress and putting people through different kinds of activities and were looking at, you know, what was the most effective thing. Turns out reading a book or newspaper for even just 6 minutes lowered people's stress level by 68%. That's a stronger effect than going for a walk, which is about a 42%, drinking a cup of tea or coffee, about half, or listening to music. Close second, but still about 60%, whereas opposed to this is almost 70%. Your stress level could be lowered. It didn't specify whether the newspaper had to be a physical newspaper or online. I'm guessing it had to be a physical newspaper. I'm guessing you don't get the same stress relieving benefits from, you know, clicking around and seeing a bunch of ads and staring at a screen in that blue light, which we all, you know so much more about. So I think that is a really interesting. You can lower your stress rate by 70% if you can just read for 6 minutes. Was it six? Yeah, 6 minutes.
Makes me feel a lot better about getting the paper every day.
I mean, for real, Tom, for real.
Even when it's the most stressful subjects, like, you know, I feel calmer afterward because I'm just like, well, at least I know what's happening. I feel informed.
That's right. At least I know. I'm better off knowing than not.
Exactly.
In addition, a team at Yale University, they followed almost 4,000 adults over the age of 50 for 12 years. And they discovered that people who read books, and they were just looking at reading books, not any other type of reading, articles, magazines, newspapers, whatever. Reading books for 30 minutes a day, on average, lived nearly 2 years longer than those who read only magazines or newspapers, which is pretty interesting.
Well, and it probably keeps you fairly sharp in terms of, you know, having to stretch those mental muscles as well. It's almost, if you think of it like exercise, then it kind of makes sense. You don't want the different neural paths and all that kind of stuff.
Or anything.
Exactly. Because these are physical things that can happen to your brain, just like it would happen to any other muscle in your body.
Well, one of my great aunts, I had several who lived well past 100. I think she was 103 when she died. She either 102 or 103. She finished her library books, set them all by the back door, and then paid bills, and then went to lie down and like looked at her like her son-in-law, and she said, "Well, I've done everything for today. I'm gonna go lie down," and died, like within 5 minutes.
Wow.
So you couldn't be too heartbroken over it because, you know, we miss her, but also like she lived a very long time and it was like she made the cognitive decision, like, I am done. I saw how that book ended.
Cool.
I'm good. Yeah. I'm set here. And she indeed had scratched off everything off her to-do list that day. He thought she meant like, I'm going to take a nap. I blew through a bunch of stuff today. No, she meant
finished
like,
all the books I wanted to read.
I read everything I wanted to read. I'm going to go. And she died very peacefully in her sleep within 5 minutes of that conversation.
Wow.
Isn't that interesting? So I think there is something in what you're saying, Tom, that like there is about being engaged and keeping your mind sharp that I'm sure is very valuable to the, you know, longevity. I'm sure. Other data that we dug up for you. We took a look at, this is kind of an interesting and nuanced one. There was a University of Toronto research team that had people fill out questionnaires about their emotions and personality traits and like did a really big, like a psychological profile kind of analysis of people. And then they split the group in half and they did something really interesting. One half of the group read Anton Chekhov's short story, The Lady with the Toy Dog. If you know that story, it is about a man that travels to this resort and then he has an affair with a married woman. The other half of the group gave, they were given a very similar story, but it was nonfiction. It was like a court case. It was presented like divorce reporting, you know, from court. So then everybody had to take the test again and redo their, you know, personality trait analysis and all of that. And answer the same questions in different orders, but the same questions. And most of the people who read the fiction version, their responses had changed pretty significantly because they saw themselves a little bit differently. They saw themselves generally kind of a little more empathetic, a little bolder, a little braver than they had before. And the nonfiction readers had no shift in their self-reflection. Their answers were identical almost entirely, but the fiction readers had like greater, like increased a sense of empathy and had, you know, deeper, understanding of the characters and their motivations, which I thought was so interesting.
Yeah. And it just goes to show that books and by extension, any sort of storytelling medium can really be seen as like basically machines for empathy because it allows you to get into the mind of not just what is happening, but why it's happening. And you see characters as real people. You know, your brain just starts accepting this as like almost a real story, even though really, you know, it's made up by someone. But as many people, I think lots of people are much smarter readers than they'd be willing to give themselves credit for.
For sure.
Because they're reading something maybe more popular than, you know, Chekhov or even like, you know, these big Russian tomes, War and Peace. Sure. But I think any nonfiction book is always trying to get at some sort of truth or truthiness that's like essential to some sort of human experience or get you outside of your own experience so that maybe you can have a more empathetic or I don't know, better reaction to someone different from oneself. Getting out of your own experience, books are an amazing way to do that.
Well, and as I said in the opening monologue, there were some interesting quotes and writing on the purpose of reading. And I love the James Baldwin one about how it's a way to take charge of your destiny. And that seems a little excessive, but really when you think about that, there's a lot of truth in that.
Yeah. James Baldwin definitely flipped the script on, the African-American narrative in a lot of ways.
Sure.
He was essential. And many people may have seen it recently in the adaptation, If Beale Street Could Talk.
Yeah.
The way he writes and the way he creates these characters is very much in the aim of getting you to understand the experience, getting you to be in their shoes for a little bit. You don't have to pretend like that's you, but I feel like he wanted you to just look at them and see someone as another person that has similar struggles or something that you can identify with instead of focusing so much on externalities such as skin color or even the clothes someone might wear.
Yeah. If there's been a book that you have read that has really just moved you or really like felt like it changed your perspective of something, I would love for you to text us 312-981-7200. We're not going to have time for calls, but feel free to text us. We will be sure and share all the book recommendations that we can. Of course, you can send me a tweet. I'm at Amy Guth on Twitter. Before we take a break and get to news and all that, I think too, Tom, we have to think about the context of books. I mean, I'm thinking as I'm saying that, I'm thinking in a big scale of like Handmaid's Tale, of how a lot of people have found kind of meaning and an anchor and but also fear. It's a scary book, but have kind of seen parallels and things like that in recent times. Like that book became popular again because of metaphors being drawn to things that were happening socially and politically. But I wonder, has there ever been a book for you that you could say change the context, like it holds great context in your life? For me, that book is Skinny Legs and All by Tom Robbins. It's a cool book. It's a weird book, but when I read it, it made me feel a little different as a writer and a little bit of as a reader, but also as a writer, because I mean, it opens talking about this is the room with the wolf mother wallpaper, these kind of nonsense things. And in the story, inanimate objects have really, they're sentient beings and they have like a very rich life and they get scared. They miss people. They do all this stuff. They have ancient histories, and all this stuff. And it's interesting. And it's not done in like a childlike whimsical way. It's actually like quite scary and they're complex and they have these, you know, personalities, and they miss their human being. They're going to go find her. So in that book, I read it and thought, this guy broke rules. He's allowed to be weird. I can be weird. I mean, to me, that was like all, a lot of the iconic things in art for me have in my life, especially when I was younger, have all been about permission to be weird. Like the reason I love David Bowie, permission to be weird. The reason I loved Prince, the permission to be weird. And to me, that Tom Robbins was the same way. That book in particular, I would say Still Life with Woodpecker was also kind of in that vein. But at that point, Skinny Legs and All was the first one I read. And I thought, oh my gosh, there's room for all styles, which was cool. What about you?
I would say when I read Everything is Illuminated by Jonathan Safran Foer, many people know for his book, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, but this, I believe, was before that. It's a book that deals a lot with tracing one's own family history and histories of trauma and how that can extend through decades and how people can be connected by years and years and years. And it was a similar thing to, like you mentioned, there was a lot of, it was a writing style that kind of broke the mold for at least for what I was familiar with. Mm-hmm. And it allowed me to think outside the box in terms of how can a story be presented in a way that is both accessible yet pushes the reader to think a little bit more and spend a little bit more time looking at the prose.
Yeah. And I know he kind of has not always been in a lot of favor. Sometimes people go, he's kind of pretentious, or he's
Even did a book that was literally like cut up, like it was in a certain way. Like he really wanted to push the ideas of how a book was read, but if you wanted something that can really be accessible yet still challenge you as a reader,
that's a great book.
Yeah,
I mean that when I read Everything's Illuminated, I think I set it down every 10 pages to cry.
It's a very emotional book.
It's so emotional. I mean, and I was like picturing my own people, back in the shtetl, I was like,
exactly.
Oh my gosh, these are really moving and scary things. And you're really, I think at the end of that book, that was one of those like where you missed everybody.
Yeah. And you were sad to put it down.
Yeah. I was sad for that to end. I missed all those people and I wanted to kind of stick with them. I wanted to know, give me a season two here. I need that. It's that feeling. I know I had to grieve it a little bit. Anyway, I'm talking too much. This is a topic I love and I suspect many of you do too. Thanks so much for texting us 312-981-7200 with the books that have moved you and made big impacts in your lives and sending us tweets about that. So we're going to take a break, get you to news, all that good stuff, and continue this conversation with author Elizabeth Weitzman, film critic and author of Renegade Women of Film and TV. Very excited for this conversation. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for joining us tonight. Appreciate you for sharing part of your Saturday evening with us. Always glad to have you. Always appreciate you for that. So tonight, as ever, we pick one big topic and we talk about it all evening. And tonight we're talking about books and reading. And now, here at this point in the show, we are moving on to my favorite part, and that is where we get to talk with very smart people who've done very, very cool things, and we get to learn all about the work that they're doing. Joining us by phone is Elizabeth Weitzman, film critic and author of Renegade Women on Film and TV. Elizabeth, welcome to the program. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so happy to be talking with you about such a great subject tonight.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited about this book. I'm holding a copy right now, and it's absolutely beautiful. It's illustration, it's biographical profiles, interviews with really, really big names. You've got Rita Moreno and Barbara Streisand and Sigourney Weaver and all kind of stuff celebrating 50 women that have done really remarkable things in entertainment. So tell us about this book and how it came to be.
Well, I think it's actually connected to what you and Tom were talking about earlier, about how important it is to tell stories. You know, there's been a lot of talk in recent years about how underrepresented women have always been in Hollywood. And although that's true, and I'm so glad we're talking about it, that approach really only tells half the story.
Indeed, indeed. And so when you sat down to create this book, what brought you to do that in an illustrated format rather than just writing it as text?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I do love old photos, but the truth is that there weren't very many. I wanted to go all the way back to the beginning because the reality is that women have been essential innovators in entertainment from the very start. But but they've been written out of history so consistently that few people were even aware of their huge accomplishments. So I wanted to find a way to bring them into the present. And the few photos that we were able to find from the very early years didn't really do that. And so I sort of thought, well, wouldn't it be cool if we could kind of connect these artists from the past with an amazing young artist today? So I looked on this incredible website called Women Who Draw, and I must have gone through 1,000 portfolios. And some of them were amazing, but when I found this one woman, young woman named Austin Claire Clemens, I asked her if she would send me a sample. And she did a picture of Edith Head, a costume designer, and as soon as I saw it, I knew she was the person to bring everything sort of into the present.
I love it. And looking through it, when I opened the book, the first one I opened to was Barbra Streisand, who I love, who I adore. And I saw that photo for that illustration first with this beautiful leopard outfit. And it's such a beautiful photo that really captures her so wonderfully. So in working with this artist, what was that process like creatively together and collaborating and all that?
Oh, it was fantastic. And I love that you use the word collaboration, because so many of the women in the book were collaborators too. One of my favorite stories is actually this woman named Frances Marion, who I wanted her to be, you know, my best friend, even though she lived 100 years ago. She was one of these women, like Lois Weber, who's also in the book, who really tried to find other talented women and support them, even the ones who, you know, as the rest of the industry was kind of pushing them out for being too old or too out of touch, she was the one who really kind of brought them back in. So I loved the idea of collaborating. It was, I think, actually an all-woman group that put the book together, and I loved collaborating with these incredible women, and Austin is amazing and so talented, and we would talk about what eras we wanted to represent, and she would take different elements from each chapter and these women's lives and put them into the beautiful wallpaper behind them that you see in the book, too, which was so cool. That was actually her idea, and I loved it.
That's such a great idea. And right as you say that, I turn the page to the Mary Pickford illustration that's so beautiful with all these little scissors in the background. That's so lovely.
Actually, Mary Pickford and Frances Marion, who I was just talking about, were very close collaborators and worked together. But the scissors is interesting because that represents the curls that Mary eventually cut off. You know, she was 36 years old and still playing little girls. And she was this incredible businesswoman in her private life. But everybody thought of her as this sort of ingenue in her 30s. So she cut her hair and it became front page news. The New York Times put it on the front page and people were outraged. And the truth is that she never really recovered from it. But it's definitely a key moment in her life.
That's so interesting. These stories are so, so good. For those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to be sure and tweet out a link to this book after the program so you can see it, check it out, buy it for yourself, because it's so beautiful. It's really one of those books. It's not just one you sit down and read. It's like one you'll turn back through and notice different things in each of the illustrations. They're so beautiful. So you mentioned one of your favorites, Frances Marion, which I agree. I want to be friends with her, too, because she sounds like my kind of lady. What about, who was surprising to you, or what details did you learn about people that you feel like people don't usually know?
Okay, so there are a couple, actually, that I feel like really stand out, even though all of them are kind of my favorites. But since you mentioned Barbra Streisand, I will follow up and tell you, because I was so delighted to learn how amazing she actually is, how kind and generous. You know, I didn't realize she's dealt with so much sexism and so much sort of casually chauvinistic language that is so ingrained in our culture that we don't even realize it, right? I mean, it's become accepted lore that she's a diva and difficult and demanding, right? But why? I mean, who defined her this way? And why did we all just sort of accept it as an acknowledged truth? So I was thrilled over the months of our interaction to find I didn't see any of that. You know, I saw someone who was meticulous and thoughtful and precise, basically the exact qualities that would help make someone the youngest EGOT of all time. And, you know, she notes in the book, in our interview, that, you know, people say he's assertive, but she's aggressive. He's committed, but she's controlling. And so she talked to me a lot about that and how much she's had to deal with that in her life. And I was kind of surprised to hear that.
I'm sure, right? Because we think of her as, like, everyone should just I don't know, bow in front of her. You wouldn't think anyone would give Barbara Streisand any grief. Who are you that would give Barbara Streisand grief? Who do you think you are? But yeah, nonetheless, there it is. Even Barbara Streisand. I mean, to me, when I hear about an icon facing a very human and commonplace thing, I think, I think that's so important to know those kind of stories. I think of when Oprah Winfrey once in the New York Times referred to having imposter syndrome just a few years ago. I thought, okay, if Oprah has imposter syndrome, maybe we should be talking about that we all do on some level and get that out in the open instead of pretending like that's not a human thing to do, right?
Oh, it's so true. And, you know, I'll admit that I was, part of my job as a film critic over the years has been to interview actors and filmmakers, when their films come out. So I was surprised to find myself intimidated before my call with Sigourney Weaver. I guess it's just the image that she has, this patrician image, right, from all of her films. And I was shocked. I shouldn't have been, but I was shocked to find that she was so funny and down to earth. And, you know, she also confessed some insecurities. And I just came away thinking, okay, she's just an awesome lady, like another awesome lady I might meet. You know what I mean? So I think it's true when we find out that our role models really have the same insecurities or fears or experiences that we do.
Indeed. I think that's so important. And that's why books like this with wonderful interviews in them are so very important. We're talking with Elizabeth Weitzman, film critic and author of Renegade Women of Film and TV. We're going to take a little break and continue this conversation in just a bit here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us. We've been talking all night about books and reading and the importance of them, and we are talking with three authors tonight, the first of which is on the phone with us, and that is Elizabeth Weitzman, film critic and author of Renegade Women of Film and TV. If you follow me on Twitter, I just tweeted out a link to buy the book from the publisher, and I encourage you to do so because it's very cool. I also put a picture because I'm holding a copy of it, and I took a picture of it and sent that out with it because it's so gorgeous, and I really think you were just gonna love it. Elizabeth, thanks for sticking with us through the break. I have so many questions for you still, but I want to kind of pause a little bit. In addition to this book, you're also a film critic. Tell us a bit about the work you do there and your background in this industry.
Oh, okay. Well, I have to admit, I do feel extremely lucky to have a job that I really love and is just so much fun. Not every movie is great, obviously, but I usually can find something to appreciate in everyone. I've been doing it for, a long time, about 20 years. In fact, I started at Interview Magazine, and then I went over to different magazines, Marie Claire and Harper's Bazaar, and then I was at the New York Daily News from 2000 to 2015. Now I'm at The Wrap, and I just am very lucky to get to see movies all the time and talk to the people who make them.
I'm always so interested in the changing role of the critic, especially in the last few years, just because, you know, I think more and more people are overwhelmed with information and often are taking recommendations from friends or something like that. It seems like trust is a bigger factor than ever. It used to kind of be, if you had this role, you were the voice of record. And now it's really, I think about almost about relationships with readers and building relationships and kind of getting a sense. Cause now I feel like you hear more and more people say, oh, so-and-so is probably not going to like that movie. They never like movies like this. And people kind of know their critics in a different way now because of social media. What do you think about that?
I think that's true. You know, I think it's a shame that so many traditional venues are kind of falling by the wayside in publishing. But at the same time, I actually like the fact that it's becoming more democratic and it's opening up. You know, there's so many different people that you can follow, for example, on Rotten Tomatoes or online anywhere. So I really appreciate hearing different perspectives. And you're right, you can usually kind of tell which way one person's going to go. So it's kind of nice to be able to see their perspective, but then to look at another perspective as well. And you have so many alternatives.
Indeed. And so this book kind of slides into that wheelhouse so wonderfully. What were kind of the first seeds of hey, this could be a bigger thing that I want to do?
Well, you know, when I would watch the Golden Globes, they have a Cecil B. DeMille Award that they give out every year. It's sort of a lifetime achievement award. You know, Oprah Winfrey won it. And I said to a friend at one point when I was watching the show, I said, why is there a Cecil B. DeMille Award, but there's no Alice Guy Blaché Award? And she said, who? So I mentioned it to a few other people, you know, in the next couple weeks, and everybody said, who? And so I thought, okay, I have to tell this story. And like you were saying earlier, it's so important to tell the stories, right? These incredible women made so many sacrifices to create a better world for us. So it's, I feel like it's our responsibility to learn their names and see their work and share their stories. And if no one does tell their stories, in a certain way, they disappear.
Right, and that's so important to do that for sure. And so when from that point, when you started to kind of crystallize that thought, what was the timeline from then to book publication?
Well, let's see. I would say it was about 2.5 to 3 years. It took a while to do the proposal and then rewrite the proposal. I actually didn't have an agent at the time, so I had to get an agent, you know, sort of go through the whole process. And then she sent it out, and it was Random House did buy it right away. So we started working very quickly. And then I had to look for our illustrator. That took a while because I really wanted to find the right person, like I mentioned earlier. And then it took about a year to write altogether.
Mm-hmm. And, well, it's...
And in that time, I should mention, too, things changed so much. I started writing the proposal before, you know, we were talking about Time's Up or Me Too or anything like that. I just thought it would sort of be an historical book at that point. And then it really became kind of something bigger, I think, because things are changing so quickly in our culture right now.
Oh my gosh, you are singing my song. I too started a project about women right before we really started having conversations about Me Too and Time's Up. And indeed, same. It changed very dramatically. What seemed like a very straightforward telling became a really big narrative. So I absolutely hear you on that for sure. I think that's something a lot of people who document in any format and on any platform and through any medium, I think have experienced that through this, if their topics align anyway.
Oh, I think that's true. What are your stories about?
Mine is about online harassment. I started a documentary a few years ago, right before Me Too came to happen, and suddenly I went, "Oh, I got to change this a little bit. This is a little bit different than I perhaps thought it was going to be."
Yeah, it's so interesting. Things move so quickly now, don't they?
Indeed. Yeah, I feel like we could have a 2-hour conversation just about that. Maybe we will. Maybe I'll find you on Twitter later, right? And we'll tweet about it. Indeed. But I want to kind of get back to the book a little bit because I just love this. I think it's so beautiful. And when I look through it, I think you did such a wonderful job of really picking a wonderful cross-section of women that are in film and television. But who, you know, I'm sure that was a heartbreaking list to make because I'm sure it started out much longer and there were some hard decisions to make. How did you go through that process of deciding who was going to be featured and then who maybe had to wait for a later project?
You are so right about that. It was an extremely difficult process because the actual truth is that this book could be 1,000 pages long. You know, we don't hear their stories often enough, but there have been so many incredible women in entertainment. So it was my editor's job to be practical. And when she told me that we had room to honor 50 of them, I kind of panicked a little bit. I couldn't imagine how to narrow down the list that much. But ultimately, I really wanted to offer stories that represented a very wide range of experiences while also showing how the industry has changed over the decades.
Yeah, and I think you've done such a wonderful job of doing that. And so what is next for you for the book, and where can people find out more and follow you, all that good stuff?
Oh, well, thank you for asking. I'm actually, I'm going to be, tomorrow night, I'm going to be at the Music Box Theater. Monday night, I'm going to be at the Music Box Theater. I'm screening, I'm so excited about this. We're showing Ida Lupino's movie, The Hitchhiker, which is the very first film noir movie made by a woman. I'm going to introduce it and talk about her career, which I do, as you know, talk about in the book. But I'm going to sort of contextualize it. So that's going to be 7:00 on Monday night at the Music Box. And I'm super excited about that.
As well, you should be. The Music Box is so beautiful, and I feel like it matches your book. It's so pretty inside, too.
Yes, I love the idea that we have the opportunity. I didn't want to do a sort of a traditional book tour. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to take the opportunity to show the work of these women. So as I'm telling their stories, we can also hear the stories that they're telling too. So I am kind of going around the country and showing different films in different beautiful and historic venues like the Music Box. And so I'm really excited about that. I'm going to do that over the next several months.
That's so exciting. And where can people kind of follow along? Because I know we have people listening from all over the place, and I'm sure they're wondering if you're coming to their city as well. Where can people go to find out what other cities you'll be in and other times you'll be on the radio talking about it and all that good stuff?
Oh, thank you so much. Yes, so they could go to my website, which is renegadewomen.net. And I would actually love to hear from people about their favorite, pioneers and the films. In the back of the book, there's a section called Essential Viewing, where I offer options for every single woman that we write about so that you can actually see their work. And so I've really been excited to hear people have been writing to me through the website or on Twitter at E. Weitzman or Instagram at Renegade Film Book. And people have been letting me know which Renegade women most interest them and which of their films they most love. And so hopefully I'll also be doing a volume 2, and I'd love to include other people that, you know, your listeners are interested in as well.
That's so wonderful. So for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to be sure and tweet out these links. I hear you asking about that drawing site, and that's womenwhodraw.com. I'll be sharing that too, as well as on the podcast, on the website where we put the podcast and send that out. We'll include links to renegadewomen.net so people can find that and interact and all of that good stuff. Elizabeth Weitzman, thank you so much for being with us tonight. I've enjoyed talking with you, and I'm sure people are very excited to hear about your book and will be there on Monday evening at the Music Box here in Chicago at 7 p.m. for the screening of Ida Lupino's Hitchhiker, first film noir made by a woman. That's super, super cool.
Thank you so much, Amy.
Thank you so much. Appreciate you taking time out of a Saturday to be with us, and best of luck on Monday evening.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you. All right, so we are going to take a quick break, get you to news, all that good stuff, back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. Hello, it's Amy Youth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us tonight. Always appreciate you sharing your time, but especially a Saturday with me. We're joined now by another author, because tonight we're talking all about books and reading and writing and authors, and it's so exciting. I love talking to authors about the work that they do. So we're joined now by Marina Mulars, who wrote a book called Welcome to Freedom Point. Let me tell you a bit about this book. Equal parts humor and heartbreak, Welcome to Freedom Point dissects the thrills and spoils of small-town adolescence in a series of linked stories that captures the essence of what it means to come of age at any age. Sounds very good, right? Let's talk with her all about it. Marina, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us. So tell us about the book. We all always read kind of the blurb about the book, but I always think it's more interesting to hear from the author about what the book is all about to you.
Yeah, absolutely. This book is kind of, I keep referring to it as like a wild animal of sorts, because I think it looks very young adult-y, but it's definitely short stories for adults. I think I always wanted to tell stories about the complexities of what we call ordinary, like small towns, and kind of these spaces that we pass through to grow up. So that is essentially what the book is. It's a short story collection that details all of kind of the heartbreaking elements of growing up, and maybe perhaps the greatest champion moments of it. And all of that takes place within a junior high, within a fictional small town in the Midwest. So it's a little bit everywhere, but I think it's a really fun ride.
Well, I want to come back to the town parks. I think that's all very interesting that they're all set in this small town, because I think place can sometimes play a really, really interesting role as a character in and of itself. But I want to kind of start with the coming of age part, because it's mm-hmm. so many different situations. And so what is it appealing to you about those kind of tender moments of youth that you wanted to write about?
I think to me, they're just the strangest stretch of time in anyone's life. I'll call it like 11 to 14-ish. I think so much happens then, and we all kind of find out who we are for the first time. So to me, we don't necessarily value that space a ton in adult literature. So I wanted to dig in on that and really unpack how these very small moments that we rarely talk about shape who we are forever and kind of make us into who we are.
That's a really interesting point, what you just said about how it's not often that space and time is in our lives is not often valued in adult literature, because I think even the way we talk about it, I mean, as soon as you said 11 to 14, what went through my head is, oh my gosh, I was such a dork, right? I mean, we don't necessarily think of those as being the best years of our lives because there's so much painful stuff there.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think I can say the same thing of young adult literature. Like, I always say that you have to kind of be a wizard or a witch to make it a big time now in young adult literature. And so I think that that space, it's strange. And I think so much great stuff happens in that phase of life, even though it feels terrible all of the time. I don't think anyone has a great time when they're 12. So I think to unpack it with a little bit of nostalgia is a fun thing to pursue.
That's very true about the being a wizard or whatever, or a sparkly vampire. I feel like that was a key role there for a while in YA literature, definitely.
Yeah, I think if you have like a lingering gaze, then you're good to go in YA literature.
Absolutely true, with some kind of major moral message there in there for sure. So
absolutely.
Well, as we're kind of talking about that as a genre of young adult literature, what is often in your mind as an author in this space, what is sometimes missing from the modern coming of age story?
I think so much of it, the thing that I think is interesting is it's always either, you know, hilarious and kind of absurd or just like deeply tragic. So I know that I try to kind of find my space as a writer between the two and really play with how this sort of tonal evolution of that age. I think that it doesn't have to be one thing or the other. I think that things can be incredibly hilarious, but also like deeply heartbreaking, and then we don't unpack them for quite some time. So that balance is really interesting to me and something that we don't fully explore, I don't think, yet.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's a very, very good point. And so when you first sat down to write this, when you think back to that original manuscript down to all the way through its publication, how radically did this change?
It was a pretty big shift. So when I sat down to write it, I was a graduate student at Northwestern, and it was the first time that I knew in order to graduate, I had to complete a manuscript. And so I knew I wanted to work in short fiction. It was just something I grew up loving, reading and writing. And I knew that I was reading a lot of young adult stuff at the time and kind of tracing the rhythms of stories I wish were being told there. So I started with just one of the stories in the book, which is about a girl falling in love with her eighth grade English teacher and like being very certain that things will work out. And so I think it's no spoilers, but they don't work out. Sure. So I started there. And I think by digging into that story and really mining for the complexities, it gave me a lot of space to explore her classmates and her story and this town that she exists in. And then it was just a matter of building out all of these things that I had planted the seeds for.
And what about the short story format? I mean, I think that's so interesting. You know, I think a lot of times in publishing, we hear that, oh, you can't sell a book of short stories. Anthologies are hard to do. And yet it's just this, like, to me, this irresistible, you know, bite-sized way to make a work of literature that's so interesting. And to me, it seems kind of freeing because you have these different beats in a very different way. How was that experience? Like, where's your mind on short stories versus the longer narrative?
Yeah, I think you're spot on. I think that there is a lot of truth to it's really hard to publish a short story collection. In many ways, I think that that's kind of what gave me the freedom. It was like just such a distant dream to have it actually be a thing. So it never felt like I was writing and searching for an agent or a publisher at the same time. It was kind of just for me and the things I wanted to explore. So there's a lot of freedom in that. And I think also there's great freedom in, like you said, building pieces and parts that can create a greater whole and not really having any expectation and being able to put in things at the last minute or take them out and have the entire book shift is something that's really exciting to me.
Yeah, for sure. And yet these stories are linked throughout the book. They're not completely standalone.
Yeah, it's. I think we were talking a little bit earlier about like books that change the way that we read and we write. And so much of my writing came from Dennis Johnson's Jesus' Son. It was just the first time I read a collection where we had one character link every story, and you got to kind of follow the rhythms of his world. So it was something that I was really attracted to and wanted to pursue further.
Yeah, definitely. That's a great call with that one for sure. That's so interesting. I love talking with writers because they'll just sit there and like name all these wonderful books and you sit there and write them down like, oh, we got to read this. We got to do this. Got to do this. Oh yeah, I forgot about this one. I'll forget about this. But indeed, we're going to link to all of the things that you mentioned and I'll be sure and tweet them out and all that good stuff because I know people will always go, what was the book she said? Where do I find it? What is that? So I'll be sure and do that for sure. We're talking with Marina Mulars, author of Welcome to Freedom Point. If you follow me on Twitter, I just tweeted out a link to buy that book. You can find it for yourself. But we're going to take a little break and we come back. We're going to continue this conversation all about publishing and writing and this book in particular. Back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us this evening. I appreciate you. Well, it is a books show. You know, every so often we do a show all about books and writing and reading, and we get really smart and interesting people in here to talk with us. And tonight we are following that tradition. We have been talking about books and writing, and we've been talking with some cool authors. And let us continue our conversation with Marina Mulars, who is the author of Welcome to Freedom Point. For those of you who follow me on Twitter, I just tweeted out a link to the book so you can buy it for yourself. It is a very charming collection of connected short stories all about coming of age in a small town. And it's so beautifully written. And I encourage you to check it out. So, Marina, I want to talk about that small town because I think place is such an interesting thing in a story. And sometimes when it's done well, as you have done, it kind of is a character all its own. And then there's the small town that has an even, you know, an even more special and specific kind of vibe to it. So how did you create this universe of this fictional Wisconsin small town?
Yeah, I will say, as every great Midwesterner does, I vacationed a lot in my youth in Wisconsin, Dells, Wisconsin. So to drive up there, we would always pass through all of these sort of tiny towns that were truly just pass-through towns that we never would pull off into. So I think a lot of it is rooted in that, of like imagining what happens in these tiny towns from town to town. So I think I was unpacking this idea of, there's a line in the book about it being postcard that was sort of left out in the sun to fade. And I think that there's a lot of that, of kind of this feeling of abandonment and nobody quite knowing what to do with this town, but also just like the thrills of suburbia. There's like major moments where they're just so excited to have like an Outback Steakhouse two towns over and things like that. So it's a great thing that they all exist in this space and know that they belong there. And I think that brings some heart to it.
For sure. And so you yourself grew up in suburban Chicago. How much of that, and you've drawn from this experience of imagining these towns in Wisconsin, going to the Dells, how much of you is in the book? I know that that's always the question that authors both love and dread, right? That, how much is autobiographical? But on some level, you know, sometimes it is hard to not draw from your own life. So what answer do you give to that question?
Of course. I say that like everything is just truly my life, I think week to week for about 10 years of my life. I think there's a lot of me in there. I feel like I'm sort of eternally a child because I grew up the youngest of five. So I am the baby forever. And so I feel like I'm kind of constantly coming of age. And I think that that's why I connect so much to that work and put so much of myself into it.
Yeah. And so on the note of siblings, you have a very sweet dedication to the book. Would you tell us about that and who that's for?
Yeah, absolutely. So I dedicated the book to my brother, Greg. I'm the youngest, and Greg was the oldest of our family, of my siblings. And he passed away a couple years ago after a really long and valiant battle against addiction. He was just the light of everybody's life and just the truest small town hero. He worked a lot in the Dells and in Chicago and just knew everybody. And he unfortunately passed away before he could read the book. But I remember when I first finished the manuscript, we were in my parents' kitchen and kind of talking about the excitement of it. And so it just seemed like the perfect way to honor him and to have him hold the book in some way, I think.
Yeah. And the book went to win the New American Fiction Prize. What was that experience about for you?
It was pretty surreal. I finished the book right when I graduated from the MFA, and I had a really wonderful thesis advisor who really pushed me to send it out to a few contests. That's kind of how short fiction works. We don't have an agent or a name quite yet in it. And I got a call a couple months later that it was a finalist for New American Press. New American Press is based outside of Milwaukee, so it was just kind of this amazing moment of the book feeling like it was coming home. And a couple of months later, it won the award, which led to publication. And so it got to be born in Wisconsin, which was a very fitting tribute.
Yeah. What, when you look back on the book and its creation, how would you describe or kind of encapsulate the creative process for you? Was it fits and starts? Was it, you know, I know part of it was classwork for your MFA, but was it just the creative part in and of itself? Was that fairly, did you have like a ritual that you did for writing, or how did that go?
Yeah, I definitely, as a writer, I like to think about things for what feels like centuries before I actually sit down and write it out. So I spent about maybe like a 6 months to a year just sort of meditating on this idea of what I wanted to create in that space and thinking about the town. And then I sat down and pretty much every night from like, I'm a late night writer, 6 to 10 p.m. I would sit and just write story by story. And I think in the end, I ended up with probably 20 stories altogether, and then I started rearranging them and thinking of this as a collection and what should lead to what within it, and cut some stories. And so it was really kind of laying out all of these puzzle pieces and building a new whole at the end of it, which was a really cool thing.
And whatever you're writing now, are you approaching it the same way? Are you approaching it in a very, very different way, having done this project in the way you described?
I think that it's kind of a new beginning. I am trying to sort of find my way into a novel right now, and it's just a very different process. I think short stories, I could think in 10-page complete pieces, and that's not necessarily the case with a novel, and so it feels pretty wild. I think, you know, it's worth noting that I started writing Freedom Point 5 years ago, so now I also just feel like a different writer. I think I have a lot of the same tendencies, but to build from, you know, a new beginning is something that's kind of wildly different.
Sure. I like the way you said that. You said, find my way into a novel, which mm-hmm. tells me that you probably have a very creative process of thinking about stories. You know, there's the people that map them out and then sit down and write them. I'm not that writer. It doesn't sound like you're that writer. But you said you had this incubation period where things just kind of sit and you sort of mull over them for a while. Is that your approach here as you're, you know, I like the idea of finding your way into a novel, because to me that says this story exists and it's up to you to go capture it.
Yeah, absolutely. I do think that I listen to what interests me a lot of the time. So when I hear a strange little story or you come across something, and if I find that I'm thinking about it over and over again or relaying it to everyone, or every now and then there'll be like a strange story I'll text out to like 50 people. I think that those are kind of my flags for things that I should dive deeper into and kind of figure out, what do I want to explore that hasn't been told about that story, and how can I do it as a writer in my own way?
Yeah. I really like how you're describing that. I get that. I hear that, and I love it. Okay, so where can people go to find out more and learn about what's next for you and all that good stuff?
I am always an advocate for Twitter. It is truly, I am a true millennial, so you can pretty much track what I'm doing at any moment. I've been reading all over LA and San Francisco and Chicago, so I'll usually put updates there. I'm going to be in Portland at the end of March, and so you can follow me there. And I also put some essays up on Medium, so if you just look up my name, you can usually find me anywhere.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for being with us. And what is, if you were going to describe the novel that you're looking at now and thinking about it, I'm sure people are like going to want more, want to have a little something. What is kind of the theme or the idea of that novel in just a few words?
I think that for me, it's the flip side of Freedom Point. To me, Freedom Point was how adult we are expected to be as kids. And I think that the novel will be about how immature we can be as adults sometimes. So that's the goal.
I'm in. I love it. That sounds great. Well, when that comes out, I hope that you'll come back and talk with us again all about that, because I'm sure it too will be wonderful. The book, my friends, again, if you follow me on Twitter, you can find a link to it. But the book is called Welcome to Freedom Point by Marina Mulars. Marina, thanks so much for being with us tonight. I really appreciate you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right. We're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff, back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Saturday Night Special. Thanks for being with us tonight. Appreciate you sharing your time. Well, as ever on this show, we pick one big topic and we talk about it all evening. And regularly, we do a program focusing only on books and writing and authors. And tonight, my friends, is that night. And we have been talking with several authors tonight about all kind of cool stuff and all kind of cool books. And for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I've been tweeting out links as we go so you can find everybody's work. And if you are going to, if you're tuning in late, all of this will be on a podcast at WGNradio.com, and we're going to include links to everybody's work and all the books that they mentioned on there. So now we're joined by Ben Austin, who is the author of High Risers, Cabrini Green, and The Fate of American Public Housing. This is a very important book that I encourage you all to read. Ben, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks, Amy. I really appreciate it.
Glad to have you. I know it's tough to get somebody on a Saturday night, so I appreciate you taking the time, for sure. So tell us about this book. You know, I there's always the blurb on a book that we read about it, and we know what it's about, but I always like to hear from the author. What is this book about to you?
Yeah, I mean, so Cabrini Green, as many of your listeners will know, was probably the most iconic public housing development in the world, you know, certainly in the country and in the city. Not very far from your studios, just a little bit west, 10 blocks sort of west of the Gold Coast. And it was home to about 15,000 people, 3,600 units, 23 towers. It's all gone now. The neighborhood is incredibly gentrified and much more wealthy. And so the book is a story of that development of Cabrini Green. And it's a story through that. It's a story about a history of Chicago, a history of the country, of all cities, and really like our values, and the people who live there. I mean, it's a very intimate book. It's about people.
Yeah, for sure. And the idea of taking on such a big topic, I mean, Cabrini Green and public housing, that is a massive topic. How did you get started and say, this is what I want to take on and what I want to do and write about?
So in 2011, the last of those 23 towers was being torn down. And I'm a Chicagoan. I was born here. I moved away for some of my working life, but I moved back about 5 or so years ago. So born and raised. And it just felt like the disappearance of that place felt incredibly important for the meaning of this city and the meaning of cities everywhere. And so it seemed important to kind of take on and just to sort of figure out what that meant for the 15,000 to 20,000 people who lived there. Like, where did they go? What was life really like there? It was such a mythologized place and a demonized place. So, like, to kind of sift out the difference between myth and reality in that, you know, which is all tied up in things like race and class and development and changing cities. And then to think about, like, you know, I mean, just even wrestling with public housing. Like, there was a time in this country when we believed, you know, sort of collectively that we would build housing for the least fortunate, you know, 1.5 million units across the country. And we're so far away from that now. So, like, what changed, you know? And even just changing cities, you know, what transformation we're always a part of, and to think what a vehicle to sort of tell that story of this constantly shifting city, this landscape, the people, movements, you know, money coming in, people flowing out, flowing back in. So it all seemed there. It seemed really, like you said, it was a big topic. And then also kind of like figuring out how to tell it small at the same time, through individuals.
Yeah. And you did so beautifully. Again, I encourage everyone to read this book. And you touched on something I want to go into more. And that is, there are so many narratives around Cabrini Green. There are so many different avenues to enter that topic and enter that discussion. And where did you even decide to begin with that? Because there are so many, and it's so important to really speak to all of them, or at least as many as possible. Was that overwhelming? And what was the process like to decide the inroad for that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. So, I started with a magazine story, and the magazine story in some ways told what happened with the plan for transformation, which was this sort of, you know, the city's last big urban renewal project, which was to tear down all the public high-rise housing for families in the city under the second Mayor Daley in about 1999-2000. And to think about sort of that as kind of telling that story and what happened to Cabrini Green, and sort of bringing in a lot of, like, you know, the myth of the place and sort of how mediated it was. But with a book, I mean, you're right. Like, I just started collecting, you know, information. It just was kind of endless. And like I said, I started in 2011, and it was published in 2018. So, you know, at some point I had to stop. But it was like, because I could constantly, I interviewed hundreds of people, but, you know, I read every Tribune, Defender, Sun-Times, Daily News Story, everything that ever came out about it. You know, watched everything, you know, read every book about that ever came up in. I mean, it's such a, like, fascinating place that it sort of entered the public imagination, sort of sealed all the representations of it. And so, yeah, constantly amassing and collecting, and sort of then, you know, figuring out how to shape that into a book. Sometimes looking back, it feels like a miracle in a way, but, yeah, that's kind of the work. I mean, there's, like, you know, looking at different models of nonfiction storytelling in a way to think that through, I guess.
Mm-hmm. You know, you touched on something else I want to ask you about, and that is, you know, Cabrini Green has been depicted in so many places, in so many ways, in film and TV and all this. Do you, as you have gathered this like expertise around Cabrini Green and built this project, do you find yourself feeling like protective of it and narratives, or defensive about some narratives, more or less, as you got into the project, when you see these depictions of it that aren't always favorable?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it's such a it's a really dangerous view to just sort of see place as like a horror story. You know, there was this horror movie set at Cabrini Green called Candyman, and, you know, it sort of encapsulated in a lot of ways how people saw the place, like, you know, an inner city horror story. And there was a lot of bad stuff that happened there, terrible stuff, you know, crime and real abuse, people experiencing trauma. But that didn't color the entire place. You know, if there are 20,000 residents, there are like 20,000 different stories. And so certainly my work is to complicate that simplistic narrative. It's also to complicate the other simplistic narrative, which is sort of like to romanticize a place or to sort of approach it with nostalgia. Because I think that also isn't really a fair representation. So yeah, I mean, for sure, like to think about how do you push back and fill in, like, you know, sort of just like the, you know, it's neither Candyman nor Good Times. You know, it's like some combination.
Right. And it seems like there's almost a responsibility, I would imagine, to push against. Those kind of narratives, those that are one direction or the other in an extreme way, because it seems like it only takes one representation to kind of speak to a broader attitude around a bigger topic, like public housing in general.
Yeah, I mean, so I gave a talk in Stateville with inmates there, and I remember one of the guys saying to me, man, it must have blown people's minds when they heard about all the violence that was there. And, you know, you tell this story about this gang member. And I was like, no, actually the opposite is true. Like what people were surprised to hear about was sort of like that there was normalcy there, or that there were people with so much agency, or, like, you know, that somebody had a city job and, you know, figured out a way to manage their own building by them, you know, with a group of residents. It was sort of the other thing that surprised people, that challenged their expectations. Because I think you hear Cabrini Green and you expect that stuff. You expect the, you know, sort of the story of urban decay and, you know, the pinnacle of it, the sort of, you know, the apotheosis of it. But mm-hmm. Like it's, you know, to complicate that.
Yeah. So you mentioned what was surprising to readers. What was surprising to you in doing all of this reporting and research?
Oh, so much. I mean, you know, one of the crazy things was that, you know, I'd find people and interview them and, you know, I'd ask them, you know, who else should I interview? And it was such like a place that was in the news that many of the people that I interviewed I would, you know, hear their story and talk to them and record it and transcribe it. And then I could go back, like, to the archives of the Defender or the Tribune, and I could see that they were interviewed in 1978 or 85 or 96. You know, there were always people like me there. Hmm. It was never, like, an isolated place. That seemed extraordinary to think of, like, how much a place was in sort of the public imagination. And so, you know, that people's stories start to fill in this really interesting way because they, like, you know, there are these inflection points where they came up in other people's writing or reporting. There's all sorts of, like, my own biases or, like, you know, limited experiences that it challenged me. You know, I write about this woman, Dolores Wilson, a really extraordinary person. She lived there from 1956 until 2010. She worked for the water department. Her husband was a maintenance worker there, so they both had city jobs. And yeah, I probably interviewed her 100 times. You know, and I still see her a lot and talk her on the phone. You know, once a week. You know, once every 2 weeks. But in the back of my mind talking to her, I always had this kind of itch, like, you know, Mrs. Wilson, why didn't you leave? Why did you stay? You know, like, and that the question never even sort of registered to her in the same way that it did with me, or maybe even when you hear it. And you know, I had to come to terms that she just didn't feel like there was any stigma living there or like a stigma about poverty. And, you know, this is where she made her home. This is how she had the things she liked it. And it just, that question was not one that she asked herself over those 50 years, you know, more than 50 years. You know, why don't I move? In fact, she wanted to stay there and she was upset in 2010 when she had to move. That's challenging of like a lot of our preconceptions and like, you know, what we think of like moving up, which even that sounds like, you know, even saying it that way, she wouldn't think of it in those terms.
Yeah, that's so interesting. What an interesting story, and I'm sure an interesting person to have interviewed her so many times and always be learning new layers. It sounds like there's a lot there. We're talking with Ben Austin, who is the author of High Risers, Cabrini-Green, and the Fate of American Public Housing. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. It's a Saturday night special. I'm Amy Guth. Thanks for being with us tonight, sharing your Saturday night time with me. Appreciate you. Well, we've been talking about books and authors and writing tonight, and we have been chatting with Ben Austin, who is the author of High Risers, Cabrini-Green, and the Fate of American Public Housing. I encourage you to go find this book and read it. If you follow me on Twitter, I tweeted out a link just a bit ago, so you can very easily find it and buy it and read it and enjoy it. It is a really, really wonderful book, a very challenging read and very important. I think everyone in Chicago should read it. Everyone beyond that should read it for sure. So Ben, right before the break, we were talking a little bit about the book and some of the narratives attached to it and some of the things that challenge you about it. But I want to back up even to the title, and that is using the phrase "the fate of American public housing." So what is that fate in your opinion, and how did your opinion change through the process of creating this book?
Yeah. I mean, it's not just the rise and fall, but it's something we haven't given up on entirely. So we still have a million units of public housing in the country, but we've given up, at least in sort of most inner cities, on high rise public housing. And I think also, like, you know, we've given up on a kind of, and like a greater sense of like collective values, you know, and like there's a deeper sort of disdain for the social safety net and similar programs. Like that's moved into the mainstream in a way that it hadn't. I mean, there was always opposition to it. I think we're in like a different phase, and so I don't think it's just about public housing, you know, not that specific like government program, you know, it's about housing and it's about like how we live and about affording cities, but I think it's there's so much wrapped up in that, you know, like I like Chicago feels like it's in this moment now, a kind of existential moment of who can afford to call it home, you know, like the very definition of inner city has changed. And Cabrini-Green seems so much at the fore of that, like at the center of that. You know, it used to be the ultimate symbol of inner city, meaning this very negative thing of like, you know, a dangerous place, a scary place, often a black place. And now the actual Cabrini Green neighborhood is the symbol of wealth. It has like the most families, the fastest growing neighborhood in the country, of families earning over 200,000. And so it's like the symbol of like this new city, the new inner city that's you know, rising home values and rents. And so like that radical shift in only, you know, a few decades, a couple decades seems part of this fate that we're witnessing. And that, you know, I think this book captures.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly. Certainly. And so you're also a story.
Sorry to get so heavy.
No, I love that. This is the show to do that. I love this. I spend every single show about unpacking narratives and really looking at context for everything. I think context is so, so important. So I'm loving this conversation. And for those of you who are maybe tuning in late, we're going to have a podcast at WGNradio.com after the program. I'll be sure and share that and tweet it out, because you don't want to miss any of this for sure. So you're also a story consultant on USA Today's podcast called The City. And so what,
yes.
this is kind of your thing. Like, your beat is about cities and their structures and the people that make them up. What drew you to that specific spot as kind of being your thing?
Yeah, I'm a city kid. I love Chicago, you know, and I love it in the way that it hurts, because Chicago is a painful place too. There's just, you know, a lot that's really messed up about it. I would use a different word if we weren't on the radio. and so it's, you know, it kind of breaks your heart too. And so thinking about all of those, like, how do we make this city better? How do we thrive and make it equitable? It's also just like, you know, it's always been kind of this fascinating place for people to study. I grew up on the South Side, but, you know, and so like even I'm learning about places in the city. I guess, you know, when you said like this is my beat, for sure. And the City podcast is wonderful, and, you know, the first season captures a story from the 1990s about this illegal dump on the West Side, and like, you know, spools out into amazing ways of like FBI informants and a sting operation that gets a lot of aldermen and sent to prison. But I guess I'm like, I try to be a storyteller, you know, in various forms, in various nonfiction forms. And my interests often turn to these areas, of writing about cities. You know, it's not like what you know, because it's not like I knew Cabrini Green, except in the sense that many of us knew it in a sort of like mythologized way. I have an essay coming out, like a personal essay coming out in the Sewanee Review in a couple weeks, which is, I guess, wrestles with growing up, you know, in Hyde Park, South Shore, and about memory and other things. So I guess I do other kinds of storytelling too. But even as I say that, like, yeah, it's about Chicago.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's your thing. I think own it. It's your thing. Yeah, well, you have again led me right to the next question I wanted to ask you, and that is, what else is next? What other books can we see from you? What other things are you working on?
Yeah, so this essay in the Sewanee Review, which will be out in a week, sort of a very long personal essay about memory and Facebook, a kid who thought I bullied him, Jewishness. Mm. Southside, you know, all sorts of things. I've been doing a lot of like work about parole and prisons and thinking about how that might shape into something, a big narrative. So I'm in the collecting phase. So like that world seems like, you know, this is like a Bryan Stevenson saying from his book Just Mercy, but that feels like the big civil rights, one of the big civil rights issues of our time, like thinking about criminal justice reform and, you know, what we're doing with prisons and what we're doing about punishment and justice. So I've been sort of putting myself in a lot of reporting places. I was doing some other report. I write for magazines. I write for the New York Times Magazine and others, and I wrote about a new district attorney in Philadelphia who's a little like our state's attorney, Kim Fox, and that he's very progressive. And he thinks of that job, surprisingly, as a way to reduce the prison population, as opposed to sort of just like, you know, give people lots of time. So I've been thinking about that topic.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. There's lot to dig into there on that topic for sure. Well, whatever it is you do next, I'm sure it's going to be so wonderful, and we would love to have you back on to talk about it then. Brian Austin, author of High Risers.
Ben Austin.
I'm sorry. I was like, I have that in front of me, and I also have the name Brian in front of me, and I said the wrong one. I apologize.
That's okay. Ben Austin,
author of High Risers, Cabrini Green, and the Fate of American Public Housing. I said it right the first couple times, definitely.
Yeah, I did that for sure.
Sorry.
Thanks for doing this show. I mean, it's really what a great, you know, writers love to talk about writing, and hopefully we can get more people interested in books.
Definitely. That's my goal. That's what I want to do. Well, thanks so much for being with us tonight, Ben. I appreciate you.
All right. Have a great weekend.